Well, hello, and welcome to the Psychotronic Film Society, the podcast celebrating the best... I'm trying to enunciate too much for some reason.
Why are you doing that?
I don't know. Anyway, we celebrate the best cult horror, sci-fi, and action films, and we're the home of the Psychotronic Hall of Fame.
Now you're showing no enthusiasm.
Anyway, the Psychotronic Hall of Fame, it's a growing collection of the greatest genre movies of all time, as decided by you, the listeners. And despite how it sounds, I'm super excited about it. I'm also Gary Horn.
I'm Justin Bishop. I am your other guy on the microphone.
Who's also very excited.
I'm also very excited because we're talking about a fun movie today. Last week we talked about, well, the last 2 weeks, we talked about our top 10 of the year. So I hope you guys enjoyed the results of that and the results of your People's Choice Award. I'm not going to tell you what number one was because you should go back and listen if you haven't.
Yeah. Also, then after that, they had Decline of Western Civilization.
Oh, yeah. We had a whole other episode. So we're recording way ahead of time these days.
We're working a week in advance.
My timeline is fucked up. So last week, we had the Decline of Western Civilization, which I nominated for the Psychotronic Hall of Fame.
You sure did.
And you had never seen it.
I had never seen
it. It was only my second time seeing it.
Yeah, and I was a huge fan of it, but it's not important what we think.
It's our show. If we had nothing to say, then this would be a very boring situation.
Yeah, it'd be a lot shorter.
It would. Some people might enjoy.
Well, what I was trying to casually lead into that you just made me stumble over is that what did our listeners think since you nominated that movie?
What did our listeners think? Our listeners have decided that Penelope Spheris' punk rock documentary is going into the Psychotronic Hall of Fame. Yeah!
Oh, perfect. Congratulations, Penelope. I guess that'll be that.
And that was last week. And this week, we are visiting another film by Penelope Spheris, director of Decline of Western Civilization. We're visiting a film that is not a documentary by any means. And it's a movie that you nominated, Gary.
It feels a lot like a documentary.
Does it?
It follows a little bit of time in the life of a gentleman named Wayne Campbell.
Yeah, that's true. And his best friend, Garth.
Sometimes I wish I could boldly go where no man has gone before.
Is that what we're going to do? Are we just going to quote the movie the whole time?
I think we should.
Because I feared that when I was watching this. Because I started like Instagram, doing an Instagram story of like my favorite scenes. And I was like, I got to stop or I'm going to just the entire film's going to be on my
Instagram
story.
Instagram's going to pull your profile. legally streaming Wayne's
every scene is quotable. But I was like, man, What are we going to talk about? Is it just going to be me and Gary quoting the movie at each other for an hour?
It could be. No, we wouldn't do that.
We could.
We could.
Yeah, it's our right. show.
And monkeys might fly out of my butt.
Oh, no. It's begun.
I see a little silhouette of a man. Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango? Thunderbolt and lightning.
Just outside of Chicago.
Galileo.
Galileo.
In the basement of this house.
It's Wayne's World, party time, excellent.
Broadcast history is about to be made.
Extreme close-up. Wow!
We're not worthy. We're not worthy.
Wayne's World.
Hi, Wayne.
It just might be the greatest motion picture ever made.
Are you mental?
Beelzebub has a devil put aside.
Wayne's World.
But yes, you nominated Wayne's World. It celebrated its 25th anniversary last year in 2017. So we're a little late to the game on that, but feels like as good a time as any. You know,
we've got
another Penelope Spheris film and another film by a female filmmaker, which we don't get enough of on this show.
Yeah, female filmmakers. Swing. I don't know.
That's where we're putting the sad trombone sound effect.
That's a good idea.
So let's talk about it, Gary. Well, first of all, why did you nominate Wayne's World?
Well, it came up originally because... obviously, last week we talked about Decline of Western Civilization and Penelope Spheris came up. As we were talking about it, I actually had another movie in mind that I wanted to talk about. But then I was like, man, kind of want to talk about another Penelope Spheeris movie because she seemed like she had like kind of a cool story. We don't talk enough about female filmmakers. She's an underrated. She's an underrated. Now, every time anybody says swing, I think we should just put the sad trombone. Anyway, so she's underrated on top of that. So then I was like, man, maybe we should talk about one. I did want to talk about Suburbia, which I honestly haven't seen. I've just heard a lot about.
I remember seeing it in the video store a lot when I was younger, but I never rented it.
And but to try to make this long story shorter, you can't watch Suburbia anywhere. And then
it's not streaming.
Yeah. And Wayne's World's easily accessible. And cards on the table already right at the top of the podcast. Wayne's World is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
Like, I love Wayne's World. I grew up watching Wayne's World, like, got it on VHS, like, as soon as I don't know. I don't think I saw it in the theater, but for some reason, I ended up with the VHS pretty young and watched the shit out of that movie. And, I mean, like, literally probably every weekend I watched Wayne's World.
Wow.
And I could, and did, even this time, having not seen it in probably, like, 5 years or so, I had that movie almost memorized.
I bet still, that really annoyed your wife. When
it
you guys
sure did
it.
Annoy my wife. Yeah. I started off and she was like, I'm leaving if you don't shut up.
That's like when me and my wife watch Nightmare Before Christmas. I have to be like, you can mouth the words, but please do not say everything out loud.
Right.
And, but then, like, This Is Halloween starts playing and I start singing along. So I immediately just, I become a hypocrite.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough when you love something that much. And I don't know.
And I do it with Rocky Horror.
Yeah. And that's a good one to do it with as well. But like you were talking about at the top of this episode, it's one of the most quotable movies of all time. It's got to be. It's just, it's like every minute or two, there's like something I think that's pretty fucking funny.
Okay, I still live with my parents, which I admit is both bogus and sad. But at least I've got an amazing cable access show. And I still know how to party. But what I'd really love is to do Wayne's World for a living. It might happen. Yeah, and monkeys might fly out of my butt. Ah, the Mirthmobile.
And it's just, it's a good story and just, I don't know. I really love it a lot.
Yeah, it's fun. We'll get into the reasons why we love it so much, because I'm on the same page as you. But let's talk a little bit about where the movie came from, because obviously most people know that Wayne's World began as a sketch on SNL, but that actually wasn't the beginning of the character of Wayne Campbell. In fact, Mike Myers started doing the character of Wayne at parties when he was 11 years old. He was a born comedian, apparently. And in fact, it actually evolved from a segment on a CBC TV series called It's Only Rock and Roll, a segment titled Wayne's Power Minute. And you can find a couple clips from it on YouTube, and he's very much playing the same character.
Hi, this is Wayne's Power Minute. All right, now we're going to look at parties. Party hardy! I want to know, when did party become a verb, like to party? We partied last night. Now, I think around 1972. Now, everybody has their own way of saying party. Like, my parents say party, and some people say partay, which is incredibly bogus. And some people say party, which is the right way to say it.
I saw one where he was sitting on a picnic table in the park that he called his apartment. And he was describing why you can only have air guitar, but not air roadies and amps and other things.
So, this started well before SNL, and it actually wouldn't appear on SNL until it was in the 13th episode of the 1988-89 season, specifically on February 18th, 1989. Who was the host of that one, Gary? You don't know?
Was it Rob Lowe?
Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, Leslie Nielsen. Nice.
And I can't remember who the...
Why did you think I would know that?
I was just seeing if I was testing your Wayne's World trivia.
Oh, okay. Didn't have that.
Garth was based... Garth is the character playing Dana Carvey, of course, was based on Dana Carvey's older brother, Brad.
Yeah. I love that this kind of evolved from, like, natural stuff. Like, I saw an interview with Myers talking about how he grew up in Scarborough, Ontario, and he was, like, a metalhead kid.
Yeah.
And that's where he got the idea. And Dana Carvey talking about his brother, Brad, that I know you can find the audition of him using it.
Yeah, he does
audition,
a version of this.
But yeah, he has a moment, and I can't remember if it was from the audition or another time, but he was talking about that, like, his brother ended up, like, rewiring their whole washing machine and fixing it when it broke down at one time.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, crap, man, you fixed the whole washing machine. And he's like, yeah, I fixed the washing machine with a butter knife. It'll never break again.
Well, my brother Brad is an electronic genius who... He was a very amazing kid. He always fixed the dryer, and we were always amazed by it. You know, even when, as a child, we'd say, Brad, you fixed the dryer in 2 minutes with a butter knife. You're only 4 years old, man. That is amazing. And Brad was a very shy, funny little guy. He'd say something like, yeah, I fixed the dryer. It'll never break down again. Then my parents would say, hey, what did you do to deserve dessert, young man? You know, rhetorical questions like that. And Brad could say, I developed a cheap nuclear fuel rocket system.
And his brother now is like an electrical engineer, I think. So they wanted to, you know, this sketch on SNL became very popular. And it ended up, you know, before long you had Madonna on there. You had Tom Hanks doing sound check for Aerosmith, you know. It became one of the most popular sketches. In fact, in the Madonna one, that was Michael Myers' first on-screen kiss was with Madonna as Wayne.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So they thought about the idea of expanding it into a feature film, and the way they did it, according to Myers, is basically they asked Lorne Michaels, of course, the producer of SNL, and Lorne said yes.
Oh.
That's the story.
So there should be a whole documentary about just that.
So Myers went on to pen the script with Bonnie and Terry Turner. These were two veteran SNL writers who would actually go on to create the sitcoms Third Rock from the Sun and That 70s Show, among others. But, you know, we grew up in the 90s, mostly, 80s and 90s. And in the 90s, like, SNL movies were everywhere.
Yeah.
And I thought it had kind of always been a thing, I guess, at the time. But Wayne's World was actually only the second SNL film ever after 1980's The Blues Brothers.
Yeah, we were at a mutual thing yesterday, and I was actually talking to your wife about Wayne's World, and
my wife, we should say, is an SNL savant, you could say.
She's
she knows more about SNL than probably Lorne Michaels does.
She loves SNL, man. And so I was asking her, I was like, I think it's the best SNL movie ever. What do you think? And she said, she wasn't sure, probably, and we just started talking about it. I was like, man, I guess I need to look at a list of all the SNL movies. Because I was sure that there were some before it. And it wasn't until I looked at that list, I was like, wow. No, it was like Blues Brothers. And then this one.
And then they lasted through the 90s. And then they kind of died off.
Yeah, well, like you just said, I mean, we grew up in a time, at least for our generation, like, I didn't realize that Wayne's World was the first of what would become like this whole period of time where SNL movies were just a thing that happens.
Right. Like, and it felt like that to us because that's when we were like in our prime movie watching stage, you know, but Wayne's World sort of started it all. So producer Lorne Michaels, who was, of course, also producing the film, he tapped Penelope Spheeris to direct the movie. Him and Spheeris, as you actually mentioned in our last episode, had worked together in the 70s on SNL when Spheeris was producing the Albert Brooks SNL shorts. So after directing Decline of Western Civilization, the film we talked about last week, she went on to do Suburbia, which is this kind of rebellious youth film, which is sort of her thing. You know, she's actually quoted as saying that she has this great quote where she says, you know, I can't do like love stories, I can't do romance or drama, but she's like, but I know... I know how to use a fucking Stratocaster,
right?
You know, so that's like her thing, you know. But she was still having a hard time getting movies because, you know, we talk about female filmmakers now and how they're unfairly represented in the grand scheme of things in film. But in the 70s and 80s, man, it was even worse. Like, she could not get work, basically because it was a boys' club, as it still is. It's certainly getting better, but back then, she was willing to take any gig she could get, including a film called Hollywood Vice Squad in 1986, which was Carrie Fisher's first film that she made after coming out of rehab.
Yeah, she had a tough time. She made some success, but she definitely, I mean, even after this film has, you know, not had the greatest success. So it's been, like, tough for her, for sure.
Of course. So Lorne Michaels and Paramount asked her to helm this, you know, big mainstream studio comedy, and she, of course, went for it. She jumped on it. She'd just done Decline Part 2. She had earlier been offered Spinal Tap, which I think you mentioned last week, and didn't want to do it because she didn't want to make fun of heavy metal. But Decline Part 2 ended up being about heavy metal rockers, but although it was a documentary, it is still sort of funny, you know? And she clearly, as we talked about last week, she's got a knack for comedy. You know, some of the edits in Decline 1 are really funny, even though the movie itself is certainly not a comedy.
Yeah, and I think we kind of touched on it a little bit, but she had a little help just trying to lighten it up on the second one. But yeah. We ended up talking a lot about Spheeris in the last episode, and she's a really interesting person just in general. So yeah, comedy was never like her intended genre, but she really understood where these characters would be coming from, which I think plays out in the movie, or is a lot of what works in the movie.
Right, because she it was like this natural progression from making a documentary about these heavy metal rockers to making a feature film about guys who basically worship the kind of guys, including Alice Cooper, who is actually in Decline 2.
We're not worthy! We're not worthy! We're not worthy!
Right, you know, right.
Like, these guys, they worship those rockers that she was making a documentary about.
Exactly. And also, I should add, too, that I did read that Lauren also knew that because of the Decline movies and her days in SNL, that he knew that she could make a movie very fast.
And very cheap.
And very cheap. Which, and that was important for this.
And which they did, because they shot this movie in 34 days in the summer of 1992. The summer of 1991. Because Myers and Carvey's SNL schedule. It was on their summer break, you know. Right. And they shot it for only $14 million, which even in 1991 dollars is dirt cheap.
Yeah. 34 days is an insane amount of time, too. And they, like, literally were, I think the last scene was them on the hood of the car doing the airplane stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And they hopped straight out of there into a car to get them to SNL.
That's crazy.
That night.
Yeah. That's nuts. You know, speaking of the car, you know, Mike Myers wasn't able to drive that car.
Yeah.
He showed up on set, and I guess you don't ever think that you got to check to see if your lead actor can drive.
Right.
But Michael Myers grew up in Toronto using public transportation and just never got a driver's license.
Right.
So they actually had to, Spheeris said that, she said, quote, "I thought we were screwed. We got him driving lessons. He was staying at the Four Seasons, and the valet would say, 'Sir, your car is here,' and it would be the Sears driving school."
Yeah, he'd say, get in, and the first day he got in, the driving teacher was just like, said something like, "Mr. Myers, I'm praying for this situation." And he said he would drive, and then sometimes they'd be at stoplights, and people would recognize him and be like, "Hey, is that SNL guy?" And then they'd see the driving school thing and be like, "What an asshole. Like, this
guy can't drive." So apparently, there's a long-standing story about Spheeris and Myers on set not getting along, famously not getting along. Michael Myers, I keep saying Michael Myers instead of Mike.
No relation.
It's because I'm looking at the tattoo on your arm.
Right.
And I mean, there's
I have a tattoo of Austin Powers in case you're wondering.
Mike Myers is notoriously difficult to work with on set. He's apparently kind of a prima donna, kind of very arrogant, but he's also sort of a comedic genius. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I guess that stuff comes along with a lot of times talent comes along with some weird personality issues.
Yeah, I mean, he actually tried to write Garth out of the original script to this because Dana Carvey was a bigger star at the time. He'd been on SNL longer, and Mike thought that Dana Carvey would outshine him, basically. Wow. So he originally tried to get him written out of the script because despite how great they are together in the movie, Dana Carvey and Mike Myers were never friends.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a rumor that they've both denied of a longstanding feud between the two following these films and following Austin Powers, because Dana Carvey says that Dr. Evil, well, the rumor is, although Dana Carvey denies it, says that Dr. Evil was based on Dana Carvey's impersonation of Lorne Michaels.
Oh, nice. Well, so Rob Lowe's character in this, Benjamin, he was Rob Lowe was coached by Dana Carvey to act a lot like Lorne Michaels.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I did see that on some of the extra stuff. I think that some of those are definitely true because I saw an interview with Dana Carvey talking about that he had some issues as Mike Myers blew up later on that with stuff like Austin Powers and I guess maybe even like Shrek and stuff like that.
Right.
But that he had his own career going, but that he wasn't a part of it, that he had to come to like terms with a lot of that too himself, that they weren't a comedy duo.
Right.
They were two guys that had separate characters that were actually just at lightning in a bottle. As
right.
They
just worked together.
Right.
Myers and Spheeris often clashed on set. There's a story that Spheeris tells that Mike Myers, who claimed to be hypoglycemic, although now his publicist says that he is not, but he like stormed off set because there was no margarine, only butter for his bagels on set. You know, one of those kind of things where Spheeris actually ended up hiring her daughter just to like get snacks for Mike Myers.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's always sad to hear about the prima donna stuff. I don't know. I think he knows that he was wrong about some stuff. Like, he suggested Queen, right?
He suggested Queen because the studio wanted Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
But he didn't want a headbang. Like, Spheeris, that was the scene of them, like, headbanging during that break in Bohemian Rhapsody. The most famous scene of the film, probably. The most iconic. He didn't want to do it because he said he would hurt his neck. And he was Penelope Spheeris. She actually said... he was emotionally needy and got more difficult as the shoot went along. You should have heard him bitching when I was trying to do that Bohemian Rhapsody scene. He said, "I can't move my neck like that. Why do we have to do this so many times? No one's going to laugh at that."
Yeah, and so he was definitely wrong at that because...
But he did actually hurt his neck.
Yeah, I did see he hurt his neck.
He was right about that part.
Yeah, but that's one of the most famous scenes of all. And I think he knows he's wrong if that's what he said now because... I also saw another, I keep saying this, I just, obviously we research and I just saw a whole bunch of shit about this movie, but there was definitely an interview for the Academy where he talked about that he was at a French casino for some reason or another, and he was standing down below and the manager saw him and played Bohemian Rhapsody, like over the loudspeakers, so he got embarrassed and he tried to get out. And he took an escalator. He said, but it was like the longest escalator in the world. So he was like going up. And as it got to the heavy part where the headbanging starts, he said he turned around to look out at the casino. And it was just hundreds of people all in like furs and tuxedos.
Headbanging. Well, that's what happened. Like that song now, if you hear it, when it gets to that part, you headbang.
Yeah, he's also said that the band has actually personally thanked him, too, for, like, giving it a second life or whatever.
That's great. Well, and as far as other bands go, he actually originally wanted Aerosmith to be at the concert that they go to, that they get backstage passes to, but the band claimed to be too busy, which, of course, after the success of this film, they agreed to do the second one.
Yeah.
But Here's the thing. So they ended up getting Alice Cooper in this, which I think is great because I think it's a good link to Decline 2.
Right.
But also, Alice Cooper is hilarious in this.
Oh, my God.
And Aerosmith is terrible in the second one. like as far as acting.
As far as acting.
Acting.
Steven Tyler's never been a great actor. Because he's also in, what, like, Get Shorty or the sequel to that
he's
or whatever.
Bad, but Joe Perry in, like, his one line is just awful.
Yeah. No, that whole scene is perfect. And Feed My Frankenstein is iconic in the movie and probably iconic because of the movie. There was a rumor that they wanted... like them to do Schools Out or something like that, but supposedly the manager had held them up at the last minute. It was like, well, no, we're going to do the newest single or we're not going to show up at all. And but Spheeris denies that, saying that she's never been a fan of having to do like the big hits or anything like that. Cooper says that he thought that, as far as he knew, that was always the song they were going to do, that it was just heavy and it felt like it was right for the movie, mm-hmm. that like doing a 70s song wouldn't have worked as well. But what you're thinking of, like Alice Cooper in the, like even Jennifer, I don't know how long it's been since she's seen it, but she was just like, what is going on? Like in the scene where Alice Cooper is just giving a history lesson
about
on Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Miliwake, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
And Steven Tyler, I don't think, would have sold that as well.
No, and Alice Cooper says that still to this day, like, he will walk through an airport or something, and people will get down on their knees and do, "We're not worthy."
I would, too.
And he'll hold his hand out. Like,
He's coming to town in, like, a month. Let's see if we can get backstage passes.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll just stick around and hang around with you. Yeah, he says he feels like if people are going to drop on their knees on a dirty floor and just do the "we're not worthy" thing, the least he could do is
play along.
Kiss my hand.
I love it. That's great. What a great sport. So Spheeris and Myers also, another big thing that they argued about was final cut of the film. Myers wanted to make some cuts to Spheeris's version of the movie, even though it had already played to test audiences and played like gangbusters, like right. Her version of the movie, and he still wanted to make cuts. I think it was, I don't know if it was just a power thing or what, but their clashes on this film basically led to Myers preventing Spheeris from directing the sequel that came out the next year.
Yeah, that's a bummer. I don't know. Like, Wayne's World 2, I think, is really good itself. It's not as good.
It's not as good, but it's still got some good stuff.
Yeah, it's still generally a good movie. It's, you know, I don't know how much
Kim
better
Basinger
or worse
stuff is.
Oh my god,
wonderful!
It is. It is really great. I love the.
Can I be Frank?
Can I still be Garth? The eye for the details stuff, and
it's great.
That's awesome. But which is a joke he'll go on to use like over and over again. Yeah. Like he does it with the mole thing and like Austin Powers or something, like essentially the same joke.
Yeah. So Gary, I'm glad that you nominated this. It is, though, sometimes very hard to talk about comedy in the context that we talk about movies.
Right.
Because comedy is harder to, like, analyze. You can't tell somebody why something is funny, you know? Like, if something's funny to me but it's not funny to you, I can't tell you that, oh, this is funny. Because if it's not funny to you, it's not funny to you.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Comedy is a really weird thing to analyze. It's like either it works for you or it doesn't. But man, this movie, and maybe it's because of we're the same generation and we were at the right time, but it works. It works so well for me. And some of the jokes are probably dated. Like kids, you know, in their 20s now watch this. They're not going to get like the New Prin jokes and the Grey Poupon jokes.
Sure. The, T-1000 joke might not play well for everybody. I mean, Terminator 2 is a hugely, insanely popular movie.
Let's keep in mind, this came out the year after Terminator 2, so it was a huge part of the cultural zeitgeist at the
time. Right. I'm sure at that time it played amazing.
Right, but now if you watch it, especially if you've never seen Terminator 2, or you haven't seen it hundreds of times like we have,
right,
you're not going to understand that scene at all. It's just like some random cop coming after him.
Yes, officers, there's something wrong. Have you seen this boy?
But I do love that this movie spends like so much time on some random fucking jokes like Garth with the taser, with the big guy and the gasworks. It's just, that's like 5 minutes of your movie right there.
Or the Ed O'Neill stuff.
Yeah, the Ed O'Neill.
Which had he not, at the peak of his stardom, pre-Modern Family, of course, but this is when he was doing Married with Children. So people knew him.
Right.
I feel like had he not been as big a star as he was at the time, his scenes might have gotten cut because they're so bizarre.
Right.
Because this movie does this weird thing where it breaks the fourth wall a lot.
Yeah.
And it's not like a Zach Morris situation where only Wayne can break the fourth wall, because Garth does it several times.
Right.
And then Ed O'Neill's character, who works at the donut shop, he breaks the fourth wall and basically like interrupts the movie to start telling this like fucked up war story. And it's so bizarre, but I love it. I love how weird. I love that the movie's not afraid to go in weird directions like that.
So we all have like these weird quirks. One of Jennifer's is like we're rewatching Parks and Rec right now, and The Office lets you know early on that they're talking to the camera at certain points because there's a documentary being filmed about this. She's been It's been driving her nuts for some reason this time watching through Parks and Rec. She's like, well, are they ever going to talk about why they're being filmed or why they're talking to the camera? And I'm like, no, I don't. I was like, I think it, and I think it has. It slowly fades out. But I was like, no, I don't think they will. And in Wayne's World, she was like, well, why? How can he talk to the camera? And I'm like, he just can. She asked like three times. I'm like, you're just going to have to let this go.
Yeah.
Like Wayne and Garth talk to the camera. I don't know why. They just do.
That's just a part of the movie. It kind of goes back to Spheeris's documentary roots, though, you know, by having the character talk to the camera. Like this is a documentary about Wayne's life.
Right, you know? Right.
But the movie's also constantly like, and that's one example, it constantly acknowledges its own like moviness, the fact that it is a movie, you know?
Yeah.
Which in 1992, that was pretty ahead of its time. Like people weren't doing like meta stuff in 1992.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. And that type of humor a lot now is the kind of stuff you see with like a Comedy Central show or, you know, like a Family Guy or a whatever. These like, the randomness sometimes of a joke, like the one that keeps coming to my mind that I think is really great now that's grown on me. The Ed O'Neill stuff is one that like over the years has grown on me more and more as being one of the funnier parts. But Garth talking to Benjamin and the robot hand moving and he just like hammers it at the end of it. Supposedly like Dana Carvey had like a whole subtext that he had in his mind of a story that was going on where Garth was building a robot to murder Benjamin for ruining their show. And so like when Benjamin comes to talk to him, he's like, what are you doing over here? And he's like, nothing. I'm not doing anything. You know? And it's like, he's nervous because he's like, well, I'm building your murder robot.
And that's great.
He says that the hand coming to life, the reason he hammers it is because he's like, no, it's waking up too soon. And the hand's going to try to like strangle him or something. And so he like tries to kill it. And he said that he actually was going to cut that out or like ask for it to be cut out. And Lorne Michaels was the person who saved that scene and was like, no, I think this is funny, and I think you should hang on to it because I think it's one of the – he said, I think it's one of the scenes that'll play better the more times you see the movie.
Right.
Or as the years go by, like it'll be something you appreciate that got left in.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. Well, there's another bizarre joke in the movie that doesn't really work, and it's the Stairway Denied joke because – in the original theatrical cut of the movie, the guy actually starts to play Stairway to Heaven.
Right.
And in every version of the movie that's been released since then, unless you saw the movie in the theater, you've never heard anything that sounds remotely like Stairway to Heaven.
Right.
It's because Led Zeppelin blocked them from using even a few notes of that.
That's insane that they, I mean, and I
guess.
They
let them use it originally and then like changed their minds?
Yeah, that's. Maybe they just want their song to be able to be played in Guitar Center. I don't know. It's tough. Oh, God, what's happening out there?
But, you know, we talked about the meta aspect of the film, which, again, like we said, is very ahead of its time in 1992. And it's something that Mike Myers would continue to do, especially in Austin Powers.
Right.
But it works its way through the film in other ways, too, like other jokes, like the product placement joke, which is amazing.
I can't talk about it anymore. It's giving me a headache.
Here, take two of these.
Ah, Nuprin. Little. Yellow. Different.
Yeah, never. I'll never forget it. And even though I don't even think Nuprin's a
I don't think they're drug anymore. Yeah.
But I still think of that anytime like I have pills in my hand.
Right. Little, yellow, different.
Right. I still just remember it. Mostly from this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a...
Well, and then you've got the scene where he opens up the door in the donut shop to see the guys like training.
Oh my God.
For like a James Bond. Which Spheeris didn't want that scene in the film. Like Myers actually fought to get that in there.
Really?
And that's a case where... I think he was right because I think it's really funny because
no, that's one of my
I
favorites.
Love it because it's like this is Wayne's movie, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something Wayne's always wanted to do.
Right. So so it makes sense.
Yeah. But, you know, these are two characters who we could probably relate to this, but they filter everything in their lives through like the prism of pop culture, like whether it be movies or music or television, probably not books. They don't seem like big readers. But But it's like these are guys who they go to Milwaukee and the first thing they do is recreate the Laverne and Shirley opening credits. You know? Because what the fuck else do you do when you go to Milwaukee?
Right.
That's what you do. It's you know, they acknowledge product placement. You know, they everything they do is through this the point of view of these two guys who just are sponges for pop culture.
That's a really good point. I mean, even the when I made the joke earlier about I wish I could boldly go where no man has gone before, they're like laying there looking up at space, and Garth is saying that. It's totally
whistling the Star Trek theme song.
Right, right. It's just a totally nerdy rock teen thing to do, you know? That's
she's a babe.
She's a robo babe. In Latin, she would be called Babia Majora.
If she were a president, she'd be Babraham Lincoln.
That's what you're doing is you're just like laying around daydreaming about.
There's two guys laying on a car, not stoned, apparently. Although I feel like they probably would be. But
they would have been stoned.
But that's an interesting thing about the way these characters are treated is that they're you don't ever see them like do drugs or drink, really. You know, you see them in the club and stuff. You don't see them like get drunk.
Yeah, I think the closest you get is I don't know what kind of cocktail it is that Garth ordered at that meeting with Benjamin.
Right, but you don't ever see them like getting hammered, you know, like you often do these types of characters. Or if this kind of movie got made today, it would be made by like Seth Rogen and his crew and everyone would be stoned the whole time.
Right.
But there's some sort there's like an almost like an innocence to these characters and this film.
That's a good point.
You know, that it makes it feel I wouldn't say family friendly, but it definitely doesn't feel, there's nothing like dirty or raunchy. It's not a raunchy comedy, you know? There are some jokes here and there, but overall, it's a fairly surprisingly clean movie.
You know, another thing that it does really well, too, that it's not ever going to get credit for is that a character like, I mean, this is a movie directed by a female, and I noticed also Cassandra's character, or Tia Carrere's character, Cassandra's not... It's the guys, like, dealing with their shit about her, but she's not ever, like, overly hung up on...
She's not hung up on the dudes.
Yeah, at all. Like, she's just worried about bettering herself and her career. Also, I read, you know, credit where credit's due, I saw that, you know, she said that she was partially cast because she was already a musician and, you know, she had the look, but... Meyer specifically wrote in the script that he wanted an Asian female.
Really?
Yeah, that should play. And it was a playoff of like these Eastern metal bands that would, you know, could barely speak English, but could rock out, do like the metal songs and stuff like that. Huh. And but he had asked for an Asian female, so she kind of just nailed the part. But she's a pretty powerful female, and she's. You know, ethnic, and you know, I hate to put it that way, but it's just an interesting thing.
Right? Like
do you know Mike Myers actually knew Cantonese though?
Really?
Yeah. Like, well, he had taken Cantonese in school, and like Tia Carrere didn't.
Oh yeah,
she was like technically born in like Hawaii, I think, and so. Rob Lowe actually spent the most time on it. He had somebody translate his lines into Cantonese and so he could repeat them into the phone. But, you know, that Mike Myers was essentially looking for a reason to use it.
Cassandra, I've got something I want to say to you.
Neholanga!
Campbell! That's amazing. You learn how to say I look pretty in Cantonese.
You know, just showing off.
Right. Yeah. Which I've heard that, you know, at first in their scene talking to each other, it makes sense. But then when it gets into like the long drawn out subtitles, which is funny,
it's a good
they're
joke.
Just kind of just saying nonsense.
Right. I love that that's part of their, I guess, romance, you would say. But I mean, if they're. Their romance is probably the weakest part of the movie, but it's also not a huge focus of the film. You know, that's not necessarily what the movie's about. It's just part of Wayne's character arc.
Well, I think that was where I was going too, because even at the point where he gets frustrated and he gets fired from the show and then talks to her or whatever and is, you know, accusing her of cheating on him with Benjamin, she's just kind of like, could you be any more insulting? And he's like, yeah. And then she's like, well, get out.
You know?
She's not.
She's not fucking around.
Too hung up. Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that about her. She's not the pining female character.
Right. She's not fucking Bella.
Right. Exactly.
You know, whose entire existence hangs on like whether a boy likes her.
Exactly. Yeah. She's just like, fuck off then.
Yeah. Sphera, you know, we've talked a lot about at the time was mostly known, even though she had done some other non-documentary films, was still kind of known. Like, I talked last week how Decline is probably, like, what she will forever be known for.
Right.
Even though she's directed a lot of other good stuff, that's kind of, like, where she... That's her legacy.
It's a culturally significant thing.
But I think that what she did, like, in Decline is she proved that she's very empathetic to, like, the weirdos of American youth culture.
Yeah.
And I think that's what she brought to this. Like, she's got this taste for the rituals and traditions that young people have, like the way that kids just hang out with each other. And I think that's shown in this movie, especially in those early scenes, like the Bohemian Rhapsody scene. It's just Wayne and Garth and their friends just hanging out because that's just what kids do. And she's got this connection where she like understands, like kids are in these weird little tribes, you know?
You said it really well. Yeah, the it's this ritualized thing that everybody does. Yeah. Like when I was growing up, and I didn't do this much because I was like too cool. Like I was outside of it, but I eventually got caught up at some. But in my small fucking town, there was a thing called, I don't even remember. It was called like the Strip. That's what it was called. They called it the Strip.
Yeah.
And it was like when you were too young to go out drinking or anything, you just drove on this stretch of road that went down like one major road, turned through the movie theater parking lot and around, and you just went in a circle and you just went around in the circle,
cruising,
just see who you saw.
Right. Well, that's basically what they're doing in this, and it's turning this like sort of dumb little town of Aurora into something kind of special because it's seen through the eyes of these guys.
Right.
You know, while they're hanging out with their friends and singing Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, it's certainly a ritual. Like, I mean, just the idea of him stopping in front of that guitar shop to look at the Stratocaster. Right. Like
which he's done 100 times.
Yeah, apparently. And you get that. Like, this is a thing they do, like, every Friday night. Well, I think you get that because Garth literally says he does this every Friday night. But
but the movie is, I mean, it's easy to call, like, Wayne and Garth kind of losers, but they're really not. I mean, they could be viewed that way to some people, but to me, this movie is sort of a celebration of, like, guys with low ambitions. Like, low, you know, like, they're not trying to rule the world. They're not trying to get famous. Like, they just want to, like, do what they love, which in this case happens to be living in your parents' basement and making a public access TV show with your best friend.
Well, how about that? Like, nowadays, like, the time has changed. Like, I almost feel like there could be a Wayne's World 3. Like, now would be a perfect time
for it. And they're doing a podcast.
Yeah.
Or a YouTube show.
Or a YouTube show. Yeah. I mean, these guys were, like, ahead of their time as far as that goes, you know? Public access is YouTube.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you could be nationally famous, like, with a broadcast show. They need to have an old-ass Wayne and Garth with their sons doing a show on YouTube. They're YouTubers now.
Well, like, the guys, you know, Wayne and Garth, they're just trying to be creative for, like, the right reasons. Like, they just want to make a good show. And until, like, of course, the show gets hijacked by the evil corporate douchebag.
Right. You know?
Who just wants to kind of mine their talent for money and power. And
excellently played by Rob Lowe.
God, he is so funny.
He is.
And this was, I think, one of the first like comedic things he had done because he had a sex tape scandal in like the late 80s.
Yeah, this kind of revitalized
his
career.
This was kind of his comeback, yeah.
He had been like campaigning for somebody, and I can't remember who, but had a sex tape with him and a 16-year-old girl, which ended a lot of fuckers' careers right now.
Yeah, but, as it should.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I did overly look into this for some reason, but at the time, the legal age was like 14 or something. So it was moved up shortly after to 16. So he still would have been within the.
Yeah.
It was in Georgia or something, you know, so it might as well be 12. But I grew up in Georgia. I can say that.
I've got black friends. I can say that.
No black people in this movie.
That's true.
There is an Asian.
Yeah.
An Asian.
Just one. Everyone else is white.
For all the credit I tried to give it earlier.
Well, it's Aurora, Illinois.
That's true.
It's practically Canada.
Yeah.
And in fact, there is a town in Canada called Aurora, which I believe is like in the area that Mike Myers grew up in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I don't know that Aurora, you lived in Illinois for a while. Is there an Aurora?
Yeah, there's Aurora. Yeah. Waukegan, Elgin, and Aurora. I just got that from the commercial that Noah's Arcade gave. But yeah, Aurora is a suburb of Chicago.
Okay. Because I've been to Chicago, but I haven't been to Aurora. I have, however, been to Carowinds when they used to have Wayne's World.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever been?
No.
So Carowinds, for those who don't live in our area. Carowinds is a theme park in Charlotte, North Carolina, owned by Paramount, like Kings Island and all those other places. But they used to actually have a section of the theme park that was called Wayne's World.
Oh, nice.
And there was the donut shop was there.
Oh, Stan Makita's.
Yeah, and it was like a little restaurant. And there was a store that was just like rock and roll memorabilia, which now is just shit you can buy at Hot Topic. You know, like Aerosmith t-shirts and stuff.
Right.
And then there was like a little photo studio. And I've got a picture of me and like, I think my brother and a couple of our cousins. And it's a replica of Wayne's basement.
Nice.
So you could like pay to get your picture. So it's like me and my cousin, like, and I'm like holding Wayne's guitar.
Oh, that's nice.
And then they had a roller coaster, which is still there, although they've changed the name, but it was called the Hurler.
No. Oh.
And as you were standing in line to get on the Hurler, the you know, there are like screens that are always like showing stuff on in the line areas at on roller coasters, and it was just playing Wayne's World sketches.
Oh, nice.
Because I specifically remember the Aerosmith Tom Hanks one playing all the time.
I really thought you were about to tell me, too, that they would hand you little paper cups and be like, if you're going to spew into this.
They should have. if anyone had been doing their job right, that's what they would have done. Oh, and they also had a replica of the Pacer, the car.
Yeah.
The
Murph Mobile.
And it was like crashed into a fire hydrant.
Oh.
And the fire hydrant was kind of leaning and it was spraying water up. So it was a fountain.
Nice.
It was awesome. And I'm really sad that none of that exists anymore, except for the Hurler. The Hurler's still
there. I was
going
to say, it's all gone now?
It's all, except for the roller coaster.
Now I'm regretting not going to Carowinds.
They renamed the roller coaster. But yeah, it was an entire section. Like, you know how like you've got like Marvel Islands of Adventure and, you know, got all the different sections at like Universal Studios? That was one of the sections at Carowinds was Wayne's World.
P.S. Have that guitar, the Strat, in my closet over here right now.
That exact one?
Not the exact one. Not the one used in the movie, and not a 64, which was the year that Strat was particularly from. Worth way more money. But
yeah,
still, got the guitar that I have at the color I have it, just based on it looking exactly like that guitar.
You know, this movie, you mentioned this earlier in your kind of introduction, but it has, I think very few movies, and I think I even texted this to you when I was watching it. I think very few movies have the like jokes to laughs ratio that this movie does.
Right.
And I mean 95% of the jokes land. And usually when the jokes are a mile a minute in a movie like this one, they half of them fall flat. But in this one, like almost everyone is hilarious.
I feel like we've been talking for almost an hour now and we haven't even touched on like half of them.
Yeah.
And there's so many good ones in this. So many memorable scenes. Foxy Lady, for one.
And that has nothing to do with the plot. Because the plot of this movie is fairly, like, threadbare. It's, like, predictable. You've seen this story in 100 other movies. But
right.
It's a good, like, hanger for all the jokes to hang on.
Right.
You know? But, like, that joke, the Foxy Lady joke, has nothing to do with the plot. Like, it's just a funny aside, but it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's all just because Dana Carvey's so funny.
Yeah, there's the weird stuff with Noah, played by Brian
Doyle Murray.
He's Bill Murray's brother. I did not know that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I really didn't
He's
know
in
that.
A lot of movies. He's, you know, Chevy Chase's boss in Christmas Vacation.
He's in Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, also, we didn't mention, I know you were going into a really nice wrap-up, but Chris Farley also, first appearance of Chris Farley in a movie.
It was, yeah. This was before he, not long before, but before he was a big star. He was already on SNL at this point, but
yeah,
this was his first movie appearance.
Also, actually this time watching it, my favorite scene is the flashlight scene where Russell has them held up at the van with the flashlight.
Yeah.
And they're treating it as though it's a gun. So they're like, just hand me the flashlight, Russell. And he hands it to him and he like empties out the batteries. And it's like, it's okay. It's okay.
I love, we mentioned how funny Rob Lowe is earlier, but I'd say one of my favorite bits of him is when he's about to be cavity searched and he does this little like flinch when he finds out. But then in the scene where he pulls up right before the multiple endings.
Right.
And you see his walk after he's clearly had something stuck up his butt. But it's hilarious. And you get to see it three times because that's how the scene always starts. So you just keep seeing it. His like little waddle into the house is hilarious.
Oh, that's great. Man, this movie's so good. And you were talking about Rob Lowe not being trained. He talks in interviews. You'll see him talk a lot about how he learned a lot from Mike Myers and Dana Carvey about how to be comedic. But he also got to help Mike Myers. He thought it was really cool watching the process of Mike Myers, who had never been on a movie set. He said that when they had done SNL, Mike Myers wasn't used to having marks to stand on.
Oh, yeah.
So he thought he wasn't supposed to stand on X's, and stuff like that. So he had to teach
the
him
the opposite of what a mark is.
He's like, no, this is where you stand. He's like, oh, I could stand on that.
So the movie was released on Valentine's Day, actually, February 14th, 1992. Again, we mentioned that it was had a budget of $14 million. Made $183 million worldwide.
Hell yeah, Wayne's World.
And that's in 1992 dollars. I mean, a huge, huge success. It shot Mike Myers to mega stardom.
Yeah, and as far as SNL movies, I mean, it's still, I think, the top grossing SNL movie.
It has to be, yeah. I didn't research that, but I'm sure it is.
I think number two was Blues Brothers, and it was like half that. Or like less than half that.
I mean, and its success, as we kind of touched on earlier, it spawned like a slew of SNL movies, starting the next year with Wayne's World 2, which was a bomb, actually. It made about $50 million. So,
but number three in the list of SNL movies.
Yeah. No other SNL movie made nearly as much money as this, because you had Wayne's World 2, Coneheads, It's Pat, Stuart Saves His Family, A Night at the Roxbury, Blues Brothers 2000, Superstar, and The Ladies' Man. And then later on, a few years later, you had MacGruber, which was an SNL movie, and that's the last movie. And MacGruber was also a bomb, although MacGruber's awesome.
Yeah.
But they haven't made a movie since.
Yeah, that's true. And that's too bad, because MacGruber was actually pretty funny.
It is. And a lot of those movies are. I think Superstar's hilarious. I think Coneheads is funny. I think Ladies' Man's pretty funny. Some of those other ones, not so much, but
I literally remember nothing about Blues Brothers 2000, and I know I saw it in a theater.
That tells you how good it was. But this movie was, I mean, it was, the soundtrack was a huge success. There was a fucking video game. There's a Wayne's World video game, which I remember playing. It was on Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis. And in the game, you played Wayne, and you had to go rescue Garth, who had been sucked into an arcade game called Zoltar the Gelatinous Cube.
Oh, yeah. He describes that in the meeting with Russell and Benjamin.
Yeah, so it was a weird game, but I remember playing. I don't remember if it was good, but I remember playing it. Spheeris, you know, we know what happened to Mike Myers. He went on to make, you know, arguably one of the most successful comedy franchises of all time with the Austin Powers movie. Dana Carvey, not so much. He didn't have a great career as a leading man, unfortunately, because he's very funny.
You know, it's really strange, like, how famous I feel like Dana Carvey is for him not to have had... He never had the movie career of Mike Myers.
A lot of his fame, I think, is just based on his stand-up and his iconic characters on SNL.
Yeah.
Church Lady and his, you know, his George Bush and stuff like that.
Right.
Spheeris, of course, got pigeonholed. We touched on this last week, but she got pigeonholed directing more mainstream comedies after this, including several TV adaptations like The Little Rascals and The Beverly Hillbillies. She actually got offered the Brady Bunch movie that came out in the 90s, which she passed, but that movie is great. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I haven't seen it.
But it's very meta, so it fits in with what she was doing with Wayne's World, but she passed on that one. She also did Black Sheep, starring, of course, other SNL alumni, Chris Farley and David Spade.
Which has got to be one of the more popular
Chris Farley movies.
I've
got a quote from Spheeris where she says, I didn't really want to be doing comedy. I was good at it, I think, but basically, I'm an extremely serious person, borderline depressed. I don't run around trying to be funny all the time. I don't think of the world as funny, but that's maybe what makes the comedy and the films work. But I wish I could have been able to do other kinds of films after Wayne's World. Everything serious got dismissed after Wayne's World.
Yeah.
So she felt like she got pigeonholed, and she did, unfortunately. Her last studio film, she hasn't made a studio film since 1998, and it was the Marlon Wayans and David Spade movie Senseless, which was both a box office dud and a quote, terrible experience. So,
well, she touches on a really interesting thing right there. Like, I think that for myself, one of the things that's really beautiful, especially since we've started this podcast, that really works about Wayne's World for me is I appreciated just how light it is. Mm-hmm. Like how, you know, in a situation where, like, I feel like everything we've talked about recently, especially when we did the best of 2017, and even with the decline, there's this deeper aspect to it. There's a lot of thought that you could put into, I mean, literally everything in our top 10, I think, for 2017 was something very serious and something, you know, that there was subtext. There was, you know, like, this is capturing something really great. This movie is capturing something, but going back to you talking about the innocence of it earlier on, I think that that's a really cool thing about this movie. This movie manages to be great and funny and just, you want to talk about escapism. I mean, this one is that. Like, yeah. This one is just makes you feel good, and it's just fun.
Sometimes that's what you want out of a movie, is you just want to have fun, right. And it doesn't have any kind of agenda. It's just, well, it does have an agenda, and that's to make you laugh. Right. That's its only agenda.
And it does that.
And it succeeds incredibly.
Right.
I think, honestly, this is a big statement, but I think Wayne's World is one of the best comedies of all time.
I don't disagree with that. I'm glad to hear you say that. I love that about it. I think that it's a very genuine, like, movie, that it's heartfelt, it's funny, it's yeah, I can't say it any better than what you just did. It doesn't have an agenda at all. I appreciate that about it. Yeah. It's just a funny movie, and yeah, it's nice to go to that sometimes.
Well, then I have to ask you, Gary, you brought this movie up. Are you nominating it for the Psychotronic Hall of Fame?
Well, the thing is after all of those things, I just don't think it's the right time. Like, I just don't think that this movie deserves more recognition.
It's not quite good enough.
Yeah, it's not quite good enough, and I just think that people should probably skip this one if they see it somewhere.
I mean, it's funny, but Psychotronic Hall of Fame, I don't know, man.
Yeah, it's just not going to do it.
No. We're voting no.
We're voting no, both ways, on Wayne's World ending up in the Psychotronic Hall of Fame. As if... As if we would end the podcast like that.
Let's do the mega happy ending, Gary.
All right, let's do the mega happy ending.
Gary.
Yeah.
Do you think this movie should go in the Psychotronic Hall of Fame?
100% I think this movie is a Hall of Famer. This movie is not only the best SNL movie that ever existed, which SNL is going to be important for pop culture for the foreseeable future.
Already is.
Already is.
It's been 40 fucking years.
That's a good point. Not only is it the best SNL movie that's ever been made, not only did it launch the career of Mike Myers, who is arguably one of the most famous comedic actors of all time.
It also spawned That's What She Said.
Yeah, That's What She Said. I guarantee you.
And Rob Lowe saying... Literally.
Literally.
I put a show in for him, and he literally jumped out of his seat.
I did look up That's What She Said, by the way. Yeah. And
did it predate Wayne?
It predated Wayne in, like, old English type stuff. And the phrase was, said the actress to the king, or something. Yeah. Like, you could look this shit up. And so it was like, when there was something with a double meaning, yeah, it was like, said the actress to the king or something like that. And the next use of it was Wayne switched it to That's What She Said.
Nice.
That was the first, like, listing I saw for it as That's What She Said.
Everyone thinks it was Michael Scott, but it was Wayne Campbell.
No, I even saw that Ricky Gervais used it in the British Office.
Oh, yeah.
But he actually said the actress to the prime minister or something like that. And so then again, when they came to America, they switched it to That's What She Said.
Nice.
So yeah, admitted That's What She Said. Admitted That's What She Said, which is great. I love That's What She Said. I think I'm with you, man. No movie makes me laugh like this. No movie since have I probably spent the time to memorize. And it's a big thing when you're a kid to have enough attention span to, like, watch a movie over and over again and, like, memorize the movie. And now, as a fucking 36-year-old dude, I watch it again and still remember I remember every line. It's a beautiful, perfect movie. I love it.
I love it too, and I'm with you. I'm voting this to go into the Psychotronic Hall of Fame. I can't add anything to what you said, but it is a damn near perfect comedy. Yeah. It does everything that it's supposed to do, and it was way ahead of its time, you know, in the its breaking of the fourth wall and stuff. But it's at the end of the day, what it wanted to do was be funny, and it's one of the funniest movies ever made. So that's a resounding success, you know, compared to its goals. So yes, I'm voting for it to go in the Psychotronic Hall of Fame, but my vote doesn't count really.
Nope, neither does mine.
So we want you guys to go on and vote. We want you to go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/psychotronicpod or go on Twitter at psychotronicpod. You'll find a link pinned to the top of those profiles, or go to psychotronicfilmsociety.com and click vote, and you'll be taken to our Survey Monkey poll where you can vote to let us know if you think that Wayne's World belongs in the Psychotronic Hall of Fame. You can come back next week, and we'll let you know.
I can't wait.
I also can't wait, but I'm going to have to.
Yeah, you're going to have to. Did you give the phone number yet?
Nope.
You should give the phone number, because we have a phone number that
we do. If you guys, listen to our best of 2017, you heard, gosh, probably 7 or 8 different voicemails. I mean, 3 of them were for fucking Todd. But yeah, you heard a lot of voicemails coming from friends of the show, listeners, other podcasters. But we want to hear from you guys. If you want to be featured on the show, whether it's about Wayne's World or any other movie that we've talked about, if you've still got things to say about our top 10 of the year, let us know. Our phone number is 864-372-9931. Just give us a call. Leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less, and we will feature you on the show unless you're saying terrible racist things.
Hey, Justin, next week it's your turn to pick a movie.
That's true.
Do you have a movie that you want to talk about?
I do. I do have a movie I want to talk about. This is a movie that I've never seen.
Oh.
I'm just throwing it out there. Never okay. seen it. All right. I've seen a couple of the sequels, oddly enough.
Oh, no, really interesting.
But there's a remake of this film.
I've always been interesting.
There's a remake of this film coming out, directed by Eli Roth and starring Bruce Willis.
Oh, I know where you're going.
Called Death Wish.
Yeah, Charles Bronson.
Yeah, so we're going to watch the original Charlie Bronson version of Death Wish from 1974, I believe.
Perfect.
I've never seen it. If I have, I may have, but it's been a very long time where I don't remember a thing about it.
Same, dude. I haven't seen a Charles Bronson movie since I was a kid, and it was just because my dad loved watching Charles Bronson, and I don't remember what I've seen and haven't seen.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I may have seen this movie at some point, but it's been so long that I don't remember anything about it. So we're going to watch Death Wish next week. You can find it streaming if you have a DirecTV subscription or Stars. It's available on both of those.
Perfect.
Stars has been very helpful to us.
Yeah, this has been nice. It's been nailing it.
So, but you can watch it for free on there. If you don't have Stars or don't have DirecTV, you can rent it pretty much everywhere else. It's on iTunes, Vudu, Amazon, YouTube, Google Play, pretty much everywhere that you would normally rent movies to stream. So very easy to find. You guys watch Death Wish and let us know what you think about Wayne's World. And I guess we'll see you again next week.
I'm excited.
Gary, are you?
Yes.
Where can you reach on the internet? Are you excited to tell me that?
Yeah, I'm excited to tell you that I'm at Rock and Roll Gary, all spelled out.
I'm at Justin_Bishop. Again, you can find the podcast at Psychotronic Pod everywhere, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I mean, that's it. You can find us on iTunes, where you can rate, review, and subscribe, and please share the show with your friends if you've got friends who are into, you know, kind of cult weird movies, or, you know, just like to hear dudes talk.
Yeah, share us. We want to hang out.
We want to hang out. And hit us up on Twitter and hit us up on Facebook. We respond to messages pretty well.
I think so.
And we'll see you next week. Until then,
may the wings of liberty never lose a feather.
And here's to swimming with bow-legged women.
Slice of fried gold.
Swing!
Swing!